Today at Reader's Corner, Martha Nussbaum, author of Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Animals are in trouble all over the world, whether through the cruelties of the factory meat industry, poaching and game hunting and habitat destruction. Animals suffer injustice and horrors at our hands every day. In her latest book, Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility, influential philosopher and humanist Martha Nussbaum provides a revolutionary approach to animal rights, ethics, and law. Examining the entire animal kingdom, she envisions a world in which human beings are truly friends of animals, not explorers or users. Martha Nussbaum is the Ernst Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics, appointed in the Philosophy Department in the Law School of the University of Chicago. She has written more than 22 books, including Upheavals of Thought, The Intelligence of Emotions, and Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities. Martha Nussbaum, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. I'm really delighted to be on this program.
Well, Martha, could we begin with a personal aspect to this book? You dedicated the book to your daughter, Rachel, who died in 2019. She is obviously your inspiration for this book. Share with us her work on human rights and how that fits into this book.
Yeah, well, Rachel was working for a number of years. So she had first had a career as an academic, but then she moved into law and she became an attorney for animal rights at an NGO called Friends of Animals and worked there for a number of years. But her special focus was wild animals. That's what that division that she was in worked on. And her particular passion was for whales and dolphins. So we talked about that a lot. She got me much more involved in these struggles. And we wrote a series of articles together that we presented at the Human Development and Capability Association, where I supplied the philosophy and she supplied the law.
Oh, that's great.
You know, I decided to write a whole book and then use material from the articles. But then when she got very sick, I mean, she ended up having a liver transplant, but then dying of a postoperative fungal infection. So this was a long period of illness. But during that time, I shared drafts of the book with her and we talked about it and she got me more, even more involved in the struggles of animals. And so then, you know, of course, her death was just the most devastating experience I've ever had. I mean, it was just terrible. But then I thought, well, no use just wallowing. I should carry her work forward and I should try to use my own skills, which are different from hers, but drawing on her legal work, to do something in the world for animals. So that's how I came to write this book. I just plunged into it and I wanted to make it as good as it could possibly be.
Well, it is definitely better than it could possibly be. I'll put it that way. I'm very, very impressed with this book. I think I have so many underlines in your book, Martha, that I think there's nothing left to underline. But let's start at the outset. You review what we know about animals today based on what you call carefully designed experimental work. Share with us just what that is. And I guess we could start right off the bat with pain.
Okay. So the first thing to say is the last 30 years has been a time of amazing research and discovery in across the animal kingdom. People used to think, oh, animals are just dumb automata. But now specialists working on so many different species, not just apes and elephants, which we already knew a lot about, but birds and rodents and fish, they've learned that all of the animals I just mentioned are richly sentient, meaning they feel pain, they have their own subjective point of view on the world. And they've learned this through a combination of neuroanatomy. I mean, because of course we have to know how this takes place, but then understanding much more about evolutionary neuroanatomy. So birds who don't have a neocortex nonetheless do many of the same things through a different evolutionary path, and they have a nervous system that we now understand a lot better. But experimental work also plays a big role, especially with animals like fish, where there's a lot of doubt, and I think still a little bit of doubt about the sentience of fish, but scientists have designed really careful experiments that show that the feeling of pain would make a difference to the way the animal behaves. And so, of course, there are lots of different variants, and sometimes the animal is given an opiate so it doesn't feel the pain. Sometimes it does feel pain. And the conclusion is, I think, from pretty much everyone, that bony fish, that's one large fish family, are sentient, do feel pain. There's still doubt about cartilaginous fish, that is the shark family, because they are observed to eat parts of their own bodies, which suggests that they don't actually feel pain. But, you know, we have to keep working, and there's lots more research going on. The doubt right now centers around crustaceans, where not clear whether crabs feel pain, for example, and insects, where I think the consensus at present is that insects do not feel pain, but, you know, you've got to keep working and you've got to keep doing the experiments. Mm-hmm. So in my book, I just say sentience matters for being a subject of justice. And then we can always move a species from one side of that line to the other.
You write in your book that law and political theory offer little or no help as to how we treat animals, and that standing seems to be the issue as far as the law is concerned anyway. Why don't you help our listeners understand just what that standing is all about?
I mean, it isn't quite right. That's right about the U.S., but there, standing is the entitlement to go into court as the plaintiff of a legal action. And to have standing, according to most conceptions of it, you have to have a particularized injury. Now, that would be fine, and there's absolutely nothing in the U.S. Constitution preventing us from counting animals as creatures who have that kind of particularized injury. Of course, you don't go to court yourself anyway. I wouldn't go to court myself. But in the case of, let's say, infant children and people with severe cognitive disabilities, the person, in addition to having a lawyer, would have a guardian to represent their interests. But animals have never gotten that. There's absolutely no reason why we couldn't give animals standing the way that we give people with cognitive disability standing. And four countries have actually done that: Colombia, Argentina, Ecuador, and India. So those countries, each by a different path, have decided that it matters to allow animals to go into court. And the case that's pending now about hippopotamuses in Colombia, where Pablo Escobar loved wild animals and brought a lot of strange animals to Colombia, and the hippopotamuses reproduced and got to be kind of a nuisance. So the parliament voted to kill them all. But then a humane organization representing the animals was permitted to go to court with the animals themselves as plaintiff. And right now, that may be influencing U.S. law, because a district court in Ohio has allowed expert witnesses from the U.S. to go down there and testify in that case. And they didn't say that, well, they would get standing in the U.S. too. But they, just the fact that they dignified that case and they allowed the expert witnesses to testify is movement. So that, I think, is the first thing. Because, for example, when laws are passed to protect animals, and we have lots of them, they're not always well enforced. So anti-cruelty laws, for companion animals like dogs and cats, are often very poorly enforced. Who has standing to go to court to seek enforcement? The answer is nobody, because the humane organizations who care are held not to have a particularized injury. And so it's a real mess, and the scholars have written about this for a long time. So that is one real problem in law. Second problem is the stranglehold, frankly, of the meat industry on U.S. law. So companion animals are very well protected. Some other species, like migratory birds and even whales in our coastal waters, are well protected by statutes. But the statutes always omit animals that we eat. So the bird treaty is called the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and explicitly omits the birds that we eat. And that's the way it is all down the line. So that industry is so powerful politically that to get confirmed in a job in Washington that requires Senate confirmation, you really have to go and have a conference with them and say that you're not going to change things. And this is really tough. So we really have to be aware of that. We can notice that European countries that don't have exactly that same political setup have made a lot more progress protecting animals in the meat industry, even though I think we shouldn't be killing animals for meat anyway. At least we should treat them humanely if we do. And Europe does much better than we do. And then finally, there's the huge problem of international law. Some animals live within a given nation. But, of course, think about whales. They roam over the whole world, and they're not the citizens of any one nation. So even though in the U.S. coastal waters, they've been quite well protected by recent legal cases, they're not always in our coastal waters. And when they're out in the sea, the only thing they can depend on is an entity called the International Whaling Commission, IWC, which was founded in order to make sure that whales don't go extinct so that we can go on killing them. I mean, that was the explicit rule, the reason for the creation of that agency. Over the years, humanitarians have joined the agency, and it's gotten more interested in actually protecting whales from not only promiscuous slaughter and harpooning, which is a very cruel form of death, but also from other dangers like, you know, plastic that they swallow, and they starve because they swallow a stomach full of plastic, which doesn't get digested. It calcifies into a plastic brick, and then they can't eat anything else. So whales are dying of starvation out there in the deep seas. There's also sound. Whales navigate their world much more by sound than by sight or hearing. And out there are oil drillers who are trying to get undersea oil. And they don't only make noise through the drilling, but also by air bombs that they send down to the floor of the ocean to chart the contours of the ocean floor. And so there's a constant din out there in the deep seas, and it causes great stress and disruption to whale lives. The stress hormone level of whales has gone shot way up in the last few years. So there are all these things that endanger whales. There are also, unfortunately, even in our coastal waters, there are problems. There are the lobster fishermen who use a kind of line that they don't have to use it. There's a line that disengages automatically when something gets wound around it, but it's more expensive. So they like to use the kind of line that surrounds the whale and cuts it to ribbons. And right whales, where there are only 340 right whales in existence, are endangered off the coast of New England by these kinds of lines. Unfortunately, in the recent budget debates, that was smuggled in, the protection of the lobster fishermen from having to use a more expensive type of line. And Senator Susan Collins went to bat for them, and she got what she wanted. So we have lots of different problems and different areas of law, but we need to make progress on so many different fronts.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Martha Nussbaum, author of Justice for Animals. The book offers a revolutionary new theory and call to action on animal rights, ethics, and law. I followed the work of the Non-Human Rights Project, especially in regard to Happy the Elephant at the Bronx Zoo. And you call their work, that is the work of the Human Rights Project, the so-like us approach. And in a moment, I want to have you talk about the capabilities approach. But before we get there, help us understand what's deficient, if that's the word, when it comes to the so-like us approach. And then, of course, you can tell us, where do we go from there with the capabilities approach?
Okay, well, of course, the main thing that my book does is to propose a novel philosophical theory to be the basis for our approaches to law and policy.
Right.
Now, Steve Wise, who created the Non-Human Rights Project, is a very courageous activist, and I admire him. And I know that what he's doing with this approach is to try to influence judges in particular cases by starting where they are. And so what he does is to try to win limited kind of rights and legal personhood for a small group of creatures, great apes, whales, and elephants, who seem to him, and this is the argument he makes, that they're so like humans that they should have these rights and count as persons in law. Now, the first thing to say about this is, of course, as Wise himself quite well knows, this does absolutely nothing for the suffering of so many millions of animals that don't fall under his definition of likeness to us. But the main thing is, it doesn't have the right reasons. To protect a creature, whether it's human or animal, you should do it because of them, not because of likeness to you. And that would be a bad reason to protect your sister or your brother too. But to protect an animal because it looks like you, it's just, it reinforces the worst in our species, which does tend to cozy up to people who look like us and doesn't treat so well people who look different. And the other thing is it's not accurate scientifically. These creatures are not especially like us. They have capacities that we don't have, and they have other capacities that are different from ours. So, you know, each creature, the lesson of science is, has its own form of life, and none is higher or lower, but each creature has evolved to fit its own evolutionary niche. So, for example, dolphins have a sensory capacity that we don't have for echolocation, that is telling what's inside an object that they are approaching, which, you know, we can't do. We just see the outside. And so, for example, a dolphin was able to tell her trainer that the trainer was pregnant when the trainer didn't know that. She made a...
Whoa.
had been established between them to indicate pregnancy. And that was because through her echolocation, she could see what was inside. Birds can navigate over the whole globe because they perceive magnetic fields. This is an amazing sensory capacity that we absolutely do not have. So all of this is, you know, this is what's interesting, to figure out what the different capacities of each animal are. And so, I mean, before I get to my approach, I want to say there's another approach out there, which is also very well used and valuable in its own way, and that is the utilitarian approach. Peter Singer is the main person you can think of in this regard. Jeremy Bentham in the 18th century and Peter Singer today think that the main thing in life is pain and the absence of pain. So pain, of course, is very, very important. But utilitarians narrow the world too much, and they don't take account of things that might be good or bad in an animal's life that are not reducible to either pain or pleasure. For example, an animal in a zoo, if it's a humane zoo, might actually not feel very much pain, especially if it doesn't know what it's missing. But it might be missing space for free movement. I mean, elephants usually cover 200 miles a day. And it could be missing, especially, society of a large group of animals of its own kind. So my approach, it's a version of the human-based capabilities approach that I've worked out for many years with the economist, Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen. It says the goal should be that each sentient being should have a threshold amount of some salient opportunities for activity that are characteristic of that kind of animal. And so then, of course, we would have to fill that in the case of each species. But the idea is it focuses on everything. So it wouldn't just ask, do these whales feel pain? And it's very interesting, a case I discussed where the U.S. Navy's sonar program was discontinued uses, I think not consciously, my approach in the following way. The whales were not feeling pain from the sonar, but they did experience disruption of some characteristic life activities. They delayed migration, they delayed reproduction, they experienced emotional stress. So all of this, the court took account of, and that's what I want courts to do and people to do. They should think of each animal as having a form of life, just the way human beings do. They should figure out what that form of life includes, what are its most important parts, and then try to make sure that those parts are protected up to some reasonable threshold level.
So let's zero in on the role of the courts. There's going to be many people who are listening to your arguments, and they're going to say, well, I agree with you, but obviously current law or politics would never entertain a theory like this. But there was a 2016 opinion by the Ninth Circuit, the U.S. Court of Appeals, that you cite in your book that just might be a harbinger of things to come.
Yeah, well, that's the one that I just described. So let me say a little more about it. So it was actually rested on a statute called the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And that said that a program must show that it had the least practicable adverse impact on whales. But all through the years, I mean, this is an old statute, people had understood that to just mean don't give them pain. But these judges who were actually sitting in Seattle, where people go whale watching and it's a typical hobby, and I think they just cared about whales. And they saw that, in fact, the whales were disrupted in all the ways that I mentioned before. And so they invalidated the U.S. Navy's sonar program. And that's what I would like to have happen more and more often. Now, of course, you have to have the right statutes. And right now, we don't have good statutes protecting animals that we eat. And then there are other problems with other statutes that we do have. So my basic message in the book is that you don't have to be in law or you don't have to be a judge. Everyone has a job to play in this large work of trying to do justice to animal lives. And if, for example, you can just conduct a campaign against single-use plastic and to try to lead the cleanup of all the plastic that's out there in the oceans. That's one thing that absolutely everyone can do. And, you know, just get your office to use cans instead of single-use plastic, because cans are easily recyclable. They really get recycled, and single-use plastic bottles usually don't. There's so many other things that people can do. They can just talk to their children, talk to your students about what animals are like and try to give an accurate picture of the real diversity and complex intelligence of animal lives, so that when laws are made, we know how to make them well. And then I think everyone has to take part in enforcement. So, for example, in Chicago, there is a Department of Child and Family Services in which everyone on my campus is a mandatory reporter, because we do some research involving young children. So for that reason, every single administrator and faculty member in our university has to do a training every year on child welfare. And if I see a child who's standing out in the cold without a coat on our campus, I have to right away call up the Department of Child and Family Services and report it. I want something like that to take place for animals, because animals are abused all over the place. And these things are illegal, but there's no place for people to report it. So I think we should all be mandatory reporters for animal cruelty. And if you see a dog being beaten, or if you see dog fighting, all these things that go on all over the place, then just there should be a place to go to report. And so these are some of the changes that I think we can all quite easily make. People can also take thought, and I think people do love companion animals. You notice I don't use the word pet because I think it's condescending. It suggests that the animal is just a toy. I prefer companion animal. But anyway, we love dogs and cats. And yet, I think most people are a little bit negligent. They don't walk the dog as often, and they don't realize that dogs really would like to have space to run freely off the leash. And so then you need to take thought for that in your own life, but you need to lobby your city to make sure that there are enough dog parks where dogs really can run free. So in every instance, so cats get declawed all over the country. Illinois just made cat declawing illegal, I'm proud to say. So there are many, many things that many, many people have taken part in. And birds, well, last spring, there were bird corpses all over the ground in front of our law school, which is a 1950s glass building. And the reason was that birds, you know, crash into glass if it's not signaled to them as an object. But now Chicago has laws about that, too. And that's because of citizens who speak up and who really want to get things done. So now buildings have to have not only these stickers that prevent birds from crashing, but they have to have hours when lights can be on, and during migration season, they have to be off at night. So all of these things are just generally conscientious thought about what's good for animals. And we haven't exercised conscientious thought for so many millennia of our existence, but it's time to do that.
Apply your capabilities approach to thoroughbred horse racing.
Well, you know, I do believe that both dogs, cats, and horses evolve as human companions. So I see absolutely nothing wrong with horseback riding and within certain limits, even competitive horseback riding. I'm a great friend of a young woman who's a champion hunter jumper, and I've been to many competitions, which are usually conducted with very good humane standards, not always, but usually. But thoroughbred horse racing, the problem is that the animal has to be bred in such a way that it cannot live a healthy life. The breeding process creates very stick-thin limbs that break in an instant, and then the animal has to be put down. It's very similar to some dog breeding, that some breeds of dogs cannot live healthy lives. The English Bulldog is a good example. They're bred for show in such a way that the standards dictate that they're going to have skin problems, respiratory problems, and that they won't live a very long life. So I want to outlaw that kind of overbreeding that creates bad lives for animals. Now, that would mean that thoroughbred horse racing would certainly change greatly. The definition of thoroughbred would be totally different. Maybe people wouldn't care about thoroughbreds anymore. Maybe they wouldn't want. And actually, you know, thoroughbred horse racing has become much less popular. Our football team is now about to move into a former horse race.
That's right.
Because the horse racing has become not profitable. So I think, you know, we just have to wait and see whether that sport continues. And my bet would be that some form of competition would continue, not just hunter-jumper things where that's mostly for form, but perhaps also some kind of steeplechase racing or even flat racing, but with a different kind of animal, not bred for an unhealthy life. So we have to just wait and see what would evolve.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Martha Nussbaum, author of Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. I thought your take on wild animals was very interesting, whether we should intervene in their lives to promote and protect them. Should you share that with us?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that there is no such thing in our world as the wild, as we typically romantically imagine it. That is a place where nature rules, untouched by human hands. Every space in this globe is a human-dominated space. On land, every habitat for animals, including large wildlife refuge parks in Africa, is dominated by humans. And same is true with the seas, as I've said, and also the skies. So what then is our responsibility? Now, if you think about a wildlife refuge, it's already happening that the people in charge think, well, we should take care of those animals. We're the stewards of this place. We should make sure their habitat is rich enough. They have enough to eat. We should try to stop habitat erosion. We must stop poachers. So I've been in Botswana seeing how the whole army gets marshaled along the Namibian border to stop the poachers from coming in. And then we do other things like spraying for tsetse flies and other pests. That's a kind of very minimal intervention, but it's certainly real and it makes sure the animal can live. Next in line would be things like if an animal suffers from a disease, should we try to cure that disease? Should we do surgery on animals who break a limb? And typically now that is happening, but only in a very cautious way, with the proviso that the animal would later and as soon as possible be reintroduced into its group and have a normal life as that kind of animal. So that's basically the kind of intervention that I countenance because it's respectful of the animal and the animal's way of life. But then we get to this very difficult problem of predatory animals because, of course, animals are threatened mostly by human activity, but also by one another. And yet there's nothing wrong with a tiger eating another animal. That's its nature and it's not to blame. But we know that in our own homes, if we have a cat, we don't want the cat eating a little bird. And most people who are cat lovers think that's one reason for keeping the cat indoors. It's become, at least in the United States, the norm that cats are kept indoors and kept from the things that would lead it into eating, gobbling up little birds. But of course, that means the cat has to have some exercise for its predatory capacities. And companions of cats know that. They give it balls to play with, games to play, scratching posts, and all of those things. So the big question, of course, is would such an approach be possible with animals that are living without human companionship? Well, I think the first thing to say is it would be a mess if we tried to do it because we don't know enough about the ecosystem. And if we started interfering large scale with, let's say, a tiger's capacity to kill a little antelope, that would mess up the ecosystem fatally. So when the animal is living in its own habitat, my view is right now we should not intervene. But at the margins, I think one thing that I would urge is that we not artificially prop up this spectacle of carnage. Ecotourism will show you, and there are a lot of different kinds of people who go in for ecotourism. And on safaris I've been on, one primary type are the people who want to see nature red in tooth and claw. It's sort of like the Roman gladiatorial games, only it's with animals and not people, but they probably would have liked people if they could do it legally. So these people really like blood and cruelty. And the people in Botswana know that that's where their money comes from. And so they set up artificial hunts where the pack of wild dogs hunts every morning at 4 a.m. a group of antelopes, and then it tears the antelope limb from limb, divides the spoils, and then eventually the vultures come and finish the story. And people love that, and they'll get up at 4 a.m. and sit in the hot sun in the jeep and watch that. But it's artificial, because the wild dogs have to have a certain number in order to do this reliably every morning. And so they adjust population size to make sure that there's a reliable hunt every day. And I call this pseudo tourism, and I think it shouldn't happen. I would not be disappointed, quite frankly, if that meant that there was a dwindling population of those wild dogs, which probably there would be. But in any case, that's my one intervention, because it's artificial anyway.
When it comes to your capabilities approach and the emphasis on sentience, the emphasis on striving, how do you deal with the medical research that we put animals through?
Well, you know, I've started my career working on ancient Greek tragedy. And in ancient Greek tragedy, you always see the clash of right with right, situations that force well-intentioned people to do wrong because that's the only thing open to them. So like Agamemnon is given a choice. He's got to kill his own daughter or let all of his army die of starvation. And in these cases, of course, in the instance, you should try to do the best you can. But in the long term, the best approach to that tragic clash, and the philosopher Hegel said this about Sophocles' Antigone, is to think up a future where that clash would no longer exist. So he uses the Antigone where there's a clash between civic duty and family religion to say, well, the modern liberal state tries to build in respect for religion into its idea of civic duty. So anyway, that's his example. But take medical experimentation. Now, in one way, it's terrible. Animals suffer and they're not adequately regulated against horrible pain and disease. But at the same time, the research does great good for humans and for other animals. So right now, I think what we need to do is just make it less horrible and invasive and painful. And that is already happening. I talk about the different things that are happening in Britain and in the United States. But in the long run, a Hegelian solution would be to figure out how we could do that research without killing and inflicting pain on animals. And through computer simulation, most people are confident that that could be done in the near future. So more and more, of course, in all of our medical lives, we're using computer simulation. Surgery is done that way. So increasingly, it's better anyway, because animal experiments, which typically use rats and mice, are not very easy to project into human situations. And people know that it's not all that reliable. So much better if there is a computer simulation. So that's what I recommend, is doing the best you can in the short term, but then in the long term, really getting rid of it in a creative way.
Martha, your book is really an incredible effort to share with readers just where we are in this fight for animal rights. And we've barely touched the surface today. Again, the book is Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. The author is the distinguished professor of philosophy and law at the University of Chicago, Martha Nussbaum. This is a book that deserves careful reading, and I want to thank you again, Martha, for joining us on Reader's Corner to discuss it.
Thank you so much, Bob. I really enjoyed talking to you, and I hope readers will feel free to send me an email if you have further questions.
The engineer for today's show is Eric Fedrizzi, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.